This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of the important news of this past week. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Jerusalem, we have Brent Nachtigall.
Hi.
And from our office in Britain, we have a newcomer to Trumpet Hour, Daniel DeSanto.
Hello, it's great to be with all of you.
It's been a big week in Britain, which has entered entirely uncharted political territory under its new prime minister. To catch us up to speed, we'll go straight over to Daniel.
Right. So it's been a really rough week for Mr. Boris Johnson. There have been a number of major developments with Brexit. Among other things, he's thrown out the words chlorinated chicken, and we've seen Jacob Rees-Mogg, one of his major assistants, taking a nap in the parliament. So it's been a rough week for the party in general. Boris Johnson is still in power but not in control, was a headline from Politico this week. So a bill was passed in the Commons to delay Brexit yet again if there's no deal that's reached before the parliament is prorogued, as we've been hearing a lot about. At first, they expected about 100 hours worth of debate over amendments to the bill. That's how they were going to try and stop this, what they call the surrender bill, basically because they're surrendering to the EU and giving them another extension. So they're going to try this 100 plus hours of debate. And then on Thursday, we heard that this wasn't going to happen. And there's now Boris Johnson tried to push for a general election, and that didn't work either. So everyone's been saying he has conceded defeat. Did he concede defeat? Well, I believe that he wants a general election, and many people already know he wants a general election. Why? Because he knows he's going to win. If we look at one of the most recent polls Politico has over the elections, what would happen right now if there were a snap election? They have the Conservative Party at 34%. The next highest is the Labour at 24%. So the Conservative Party is being projected to win by a pretty big margin if there were to be a snap election right now.
So that means the more that these numbers are apparent, the more desperate his opponents become to do whatever is required to prevent him from being able to push this through.
Right. We're seeing them pull out every single stop they can think of. Everything from stopping the snap election to we're seeing even people in his own party rebelling and going over to the other parties to try and stop him. And of course, he's kicked them out. Sadly, one of those who actually rebelled and voted for the Labour Party proposition was Nicholas Soames, and he's actually the grandson of Winston Churchill. So it's quite a betrayal in a way. Even Boris Johnson's own brother simply stepped down from politics right now because, well, as he said, tensions between his family loyalties and his party.
Stephen Fleury has been talking about this quite a bit on the Trumpet Daily radio show this week, and just one of the very important points that he's making, tying this in with the same trend that we're seeing in the United States, where you have politicians who essentially believe that they know what is right, and they're considerably to the left of the populace that they claim to represent, and they're willing to violate the will of the people and even break the law as they go about trying to implement what they believe is in the best interest of their nation. In this case, they're violating rules of British law while they're accusing Boris Johnson of doing exactly that. Maybe you could just talk about that for a bit.
Right. Well, right now we can see the legislation is supposed to be controlled by the government, right? The legislation timetable is the government's prerogative. It's their decision when to talk about what, when to pass what legislation normally. But we've seen that upended recently as they voted to take control. The opposition, the Commons now basically has control of that legislation, whereas normally it would be up to the ruling government. So they are in control of what is being done here. And one of the MPs, Rory Stewart, has said, because Britain's constitution is not written down, it's more an oral constitution. It's not actually a written down one like in the US. So he said it's getting hard now to actually stop people from pushing too far. Because Labour is trying to, they're upending basically every tradition, whatever they have to, in order to force their will upon everyone else. Mm-hmm. So he's saying, well, it's basically getting ungovernable. Back in the old days when we had the monarchy, when we had a stable governing force, this wasn't a problem because tradition would be kept and there wouldn't really be much of a question about it. Now you have Boris Johnson even going to the Queen to get permission to prorogue Parliament. That normally wouldn't be an issue at all, but Labour has made it a huge issue now. And everyone's questioning, well, is this constitutional? Can we do it? They're criticizing Boris Johnson for asking the Queen permission. Yet they, the Labour Party and all the opposition, are fundamentally overturning the ruling government's prerogatives by taking control of that legislative timetable in Parliament.
So it's very difficult to see exactly what direction this is going to go, but do you have any ideas? I think it seems like those who want to remain in the European Union are feeling pretty good about what happened this past week, but there's just so much still at play. It's hard to know what might happen going forward. Any predictions?
Exactly. Well, this week is definitely seen as a victory for the Remain camp. But I'd like to say for now, it's a victory for now. They've won battle, but Boris Johnson still does have options. This could go a number of ways. If you look at any of the articles that are being published on it, some of them will have these really complex flowcharts showing this is what will happen if the bill is passed. This is what will happen if the bill isn't passed. This is what will happen if there's an election. Really, so many things could happen. And that's part of having an unwritten constitution. There are just so many different things that could happen that could fail or succeed on both sides that we don't really know. Mm-hmm. Of course, Boris Johnson's opposition could come together. But right now, it also looks like they're incredibly divided and they're having squabbles amongst themselves. Again, just like what we're seeing in the United States. So it really could go either way. But we do know that Mr. Fleury has talked extensively, as Mr. Armstrong before him, about Britain leaving the EU. Right now, many people are still saying it's not going to happen. Of course, there are people who are just as convinced that it will happen. But we can definitely look at that and we can see that, well, this Boris Johnson's options aren't over yet. So it's far from conclusive. We can't say he's failed just yet, although many people would like to.
Well, we will put a link to Richard Palmer's article, his trumpet brief from earlier in the week, Brexit, the fight is on. That was before some of the more dramatic developments that occurred the following day. Stephen Fleury has a couple of shows that he's given talking about this as well on Wednesday and Thursday. We'll put links to those as well. And we'll keep our eyes on it. Richard Palmer picked an interesting week to go on vacation. He's going to have a lot of work waiting for him when he comes back into the office on Monday, and we'll look forward to hearing from him as well. Thanks so much for that, Daniel. Well, despite international efforts to pry Iran out of Syria, it appears Iran has no intention of cooperating. To learn about its recent activity there, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Just this past week, Fox News announced the construction of a new Iraq-Syria border crossing. And this wasn't a border crossing that is being constructed by the Syrians or even the Iraqis. This is a border crossing that is being constructed by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. These are a group, a foreign terrorist organization designated as such by the United States. They answer of they're part of Iran's military, and they are building a new military base, basically. It's not just a border crossing with a boom gate where you can go across and come through. It is a transit point. A military transit point and a place to house military hardware by the Iranians on this border between Syria and Iraq, something that we've known that they've wanted to do, really kind of dissolve this border in eastern Syria, make these two states of Iraq and Syria just make a transit zone in their desired goal, furtherance of the desired goal of creating this pathway, the Shia Crescent, they've called it, from Iran through Iraq into Syria to the Mediterranean. You need roadways to do that. The roads exist between Syria and Iraq, and then you need those borders opening. And who's going to run those border crossings? Well, it looks like the Iranians are setting up shop to do just that.
Put this in context for us, Brent, with what has been happening that has aimed at getting Iran out. And why this is so critical. And this is obviously something that just didn't just occur overnight. This is something that they've been building for a while now.
Right. So the satellite imagery here in terms of the border crossing and the military is the base. It's basically a military base on the border here between Syria and Iraq. That has been in construction for about the past month and a half based on the satellite imagery. But of course, with the knowledge that they've wanted to do such a thing. Right now, you have Syria, which Iran is using Syrian territory to fight against Israel, to try and establish numerous military bases inside Syria to use as a way of attacking Israel, or even just furthering Iran's entrenchment in that nation, so that even if the Syrian government eventually decided they didn't like Iran, it would be very hard for Iran to get out. Now, Israel has said that's a red line, and that's why you've seen over 1,000 strikes, Israeli strikes against Iranian positions inside Syria in the past 5 or 6 years. Now, if they're going to continue to with this goal, they look to be undaunted by this. And I think that this type of border crossing shows that they are, construction of such a thing shows that they are still very much wanting this goal. But what it also shows is it feels like, I feel like it's another indication that Iran feels that Iraq is safely in its territory, in its hold, let's put it that way, so that it can be the one that governs this border between the two nations, seeing them basically as one unit.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. That tells you just how much Iraq is almost like an extension of Iranian territory here.
Yeah, exactly. I think what's also interesting about this as well, in terms of biblical prophecy, we know that this area of eastern Syria is something that needs to be watched. It's a very barren, very barren area. I mean, you have the Euphrates that kind of goes through the middle there. You have some oil fields in the northeast of Syria. But in terms of like a geographic landmark that separates Iraq from Syria, there is none. This is the border that was created in 1917, just after the First World War, to create these two states of Syria and Iraq. But as far as the people goes, I mean, similar people exist on either side of this border. And so Iran really does feel like it's a border that should be dissolved. And in their growing empire, that's what they want. But the Bible, interestingly enough, shows that Iran's influence based on the King of the South, which we talk about a lot, which is the Iranian-led alliance, that's basically going to stop around where they're building this military base right in eastern Syria, because we know that eventually, although Iran is entrenched right now in Syria, that Syria is going to come out from the Iranian hold. And so if we see Iran building up their military presence on this border region, we have to think that there might be that might encourage further Israeli action against Iran in this border area, which means eastern Syria is going to get more attention militarily from Israel. You also have just about, I guess it's about 100 kilometers south of this, you have the Al-Tanf American base, which is on one of these other border crossings between Syria and Iraq. And then just north of this border crossing, you have the Kurds, and embedded with those forces, you have European and U.S. fighters. And so it's like you have this line between Syria and Iraq, that you have U.S. influence, European influence, Iran right there, have a border crossing, and then the U.S. And it's like the attention of this fight is coming to eastern Syria, which is what we expect to happen eventually for this break to take place between Syria and Iran.
It's a really fascinating situation here. We've talked so much about this prophesied split between Syria and Iran, and the way that you're describing the geography there with America having a base close by, Europe having a base close by, it does seem like Iran is doing what it tends to do, and that is to take provocative action and to be somewhat heedless of what consequences it may face for this type of thing. And it's gotten away with that quite a lot. But you do wonder at some point, like it describes there in Daniel 11, in that passage toward the end, verse 40 and on, its pushing is going to provoke a strong response from Europe. And you look at what is the alliance that's prophesied between Syria and Europe. At some point, Europe is going to say, we've had enough of this. And the fact that it has a base so close by there, it does seem like it's at least something to watch. Exactly how that plays out would be hard to say at this point, but certainly a lot of interesting factors at play here.
Yeah, it certainly is. And I think that does provide some clarity for people that are watching this. Syria can be a very confusing topic for sure, given how many interested parties there are. But prophecy does delineate that Iran will be out and Europe will be in. And here we have them coming in pretty close proximity, some European forces, some French forces north of them at this border crossing. It does show that if Europe is going to think of it its mission of having any value whatsoever, that they have to contend with Iran at some point, because mm-hmm. Iran is turning Syria into a base. These border crossings are allowing them to do so, its own base. And so Syria, of course, has been the cause of so many European woes with the migrants coming in. And if Iran's in Syria, that problem always is a threat to Europe, because Iran will never back down from stop fighting against Israel, from using it. Israel can't back down from allowing Iran to use it. And so there's going to be a destabilized state. And that's always one major war, one major battle of sending another wave of migrants to Europe. And so there are a number of factors, and Europe is the one that stands to lose the most from continued instability in Syria. And so given the troops are close, maybe we'll see more action there between the two. Warren Reitz is just writing an article about this. It's entitled "Iran Builds New Military Base in Eastern Syria." It should be up on the website in the next day or so, so people could read that for more information.
Excellent. We look forward to reading that article, and thank you for that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. Over to Asia and the increasing military cooperation between Russia and India. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, on Wednesday, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi called Russian President Vladimir Putin a close friend. And the two of them said that they'll be boosting their trade ties, their energy ties, and most importantly, their military ties. This was in Vladivostok, Russia, and the two men met there. They discussed reaching a new stage in collaboration between Russia and India. And the numbers here really do show just a rapidly burgeoning relationship. Trade between them reached about $11 billion last year. And much of that is weapons that India buys from Russia, including the $5 billion that India spent on Russia's vaunted S-400 missile defense system last year, despite the possibility of U.S. sanctions coming on India for that transaction. And then much of the Russo-Indian trade is related to weapons manufacturing programs that Russia is helping India develop on its own soil. India wants to be able to begin producing more of its own weaponry and modernize its armed forces using Russian know-how for a lot of that, and just become a little bit more self-reliant, I guess, in that regard. So it's quite a high level of Russo-Indian cooperation, and now after this meeting on Wednesday, the cooperation between them is set to grow to, you know, to achieve even greater heights.
And at the same time that this is taking place between India and Russia, India is also strengthening its economic ties, at least with China, is that right?
That's right. In a separate development this week, there was a report published by The Diplomat showing that India is now the number one borrower from China's Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, the AIIB. So the AIIB was established by China back in 2016, and its purpose from the start was basically just to advance and to increase China's global power on the world stage. The bank offers nations an alternative to the post-World War II options that are essentially dominated by America, the World Bank, for example, the International Monetary Fund. The AIIB is sort of an alternative to that, and it's essentially another economic weapon for China to openly challenge American leadership. And from the start, the U.S. tried to convince its allies and partners not to take part in this Chinese bank. But one by one, many of them signed on. And as they did, former U.S. Treasury Secretary Larry Summers wrote, quote, "This may be remembered as the moment the U.S. lost its role as the underwriter of the global economic system," end quote. And then Luxembourg's finance minister said at the time that the AIIB's success in attracting so many countries that had previously relied on the U.S. financial systems was, quote, "further proof of the rebalancing of the world economy." So the AIIB is viewed as quite a game changer, and India has been on board since the beginning, really. Even though India and China always have plenty of political tussles and disputes, they have drawn economically very close under the framework of this bank. And India has just kept on relying on it more and more over the years. The AIIB now has approved 10 projects for India, and two more are under review. So it shows that in one really significant sector, India-China ties have a solid foundation.
Yeah, well, how significant is this, or how remarkable that India and China would be cooperating on this level, given their differences historically?
Well, I think it is quite significant, particularly since the AIIB is branded as sort of being under the umbrella of China's Belt and Road Initiative. And that's a project that India has defied in many ways. They're terrified to see China kind of building these inroads through the whole continent there. But yet, when it comes to the financial aspect of the Belt and Road, India seems to be signing on, and they're even allowing some of these projects to be built there inside of India.
What does it say about, say, what has historically been a fairly strong alliance between the United States and India, that India is increasing its military cooperation with Russia?
Well, yeah, I think that's really the main aspect of this story. India, of course, formerly a British colony, they speak English there. They have been partners with the U.S., not really allies. They were historically non-aligned during the Cold War. They tried to kind of walk the tightrope there. But what a wasted opportunity for us to now be losing our bond with this nation that has so much potential in every regard, a common language with us, and yet now it seems to be slipping more and more into the Russia-led camp there. So it is quite significant.
And it is exactly as we would expect based on Bible prophecy.
That's right, yes. Bible prophecy says there will be an Asian army of 200 million soldiers that will be one of the main players in the third and final world war, which the world is just on the verge of right now. And we have a booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy that goes into detail about the various Bible passages that discuss this Asian force. And it discusses one passage in Ezekiel 38, 1 and 2, which shows that it'll be led by Russia, with China in kind of a position of secondary leadership. And then in verse 5, it lists some ancient names for the peoples that primarily make up modern India. And it says that the Indians will also be a part of this bloc led by Russia and China. So when we see India today drawing closer to Russia and also forming these ties with China, it really is building the foundation for India to take its prophesied place in this bloc.
Well, thank you for that, Jeremiah. We'll put a link to Russia and China in Prophecy, and the chapter in that booklet on India, Asia's other economic powerhouse, in the show notes for the program today. The U.S. race for the next president is getting weirder and weirder. More evidence emerging all the time just how radical the left in America has become. To learn the latest, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, as the next presidential race heats up, one of the primary issues is going to be climate change. There's actually a town hall, as they call it, on CNN yesterday with 10 Democratic presidential candidates that talked for 7 hours, a seven-hour talkathon on all the proposals they want to do to combat climate change. And they just keep getting more and more radical as the 7 hours progressed. I brought just a few of the topics that they're talking about, probably on the lesser radical end of the things, and that's not saying much. It was a proposal by Julian Castro saying that his very first act as president, if he would be elected, would be to issue an executive order on the very first afternoon he's in the Oval Office to put America back in the Paris Climate Change Accord so we can start spending $100 billion a year in funds to other nations to allegedly combat climate change. Kamala Harris said that she thinks the best thing to do to combat climate change would be to start suing big oil companies like ExxonMobil for their efforts to convince people that climate change is overhyped, basically saying that any oil company that doesn't toe the government line that carbon emissions are causing the end of Western civilization as we know it will be on the hook to be able to be sued by the government. Pete Buttigieg says the main thing that's leading the destruction of the earth is hamburgers. he's like, if you've eaten a hamburger this week, you're part of the problem. I think later on some of the other candidates talked about possibly even having a meat tax to try to disincentivize people who want to destroy right. the earth by eating hamburgers.
Yeah, doesn't one of the European countries has a meat tax? It seems like one of the people who stood up in the audience mentioned the fact that the question that was posed to Kamala Harris was would you support a meat tax like I forget which country it is, Sweden or something.
It wouldn't surprise me at all. I don't know which country it is off the top of my head either, but the United Nations has proposed that before. Mm-hmm. Just the idea that like methane emissions from cows is what's heating up the earth.
Yeah.
And therefore you need to stop eating meat.
So all of these issues that the Democrats are addressing, these earth-shaking crises such as hamburger production, this is obviously something that the vast majority of Americans are deeply concerned about, and this is sure to vaunt the next Democratic candidate into the presidency, I would think, now that somebody is finally getting to the real crux of what's important.
Yes, we have waited 240 years for someone to address the hamburger crisis in this nation, but it's...
Any other examples of extreme... Stephen Fleury talked about this on the program this morning, and he played a clip from Grabian that was just one thing after another that the Democratic candidates want to ban. And you would think that this really, well, maybe you could just talk about some of the other things that they're proposing here.
Right. Well, the two other ones, which are trending more and more radical, is Andrew Yang actually proposed an amendment to the Constitution, like a green amendment that just clarifies that it's the federal government's responsibility to ban all these things that they've talked about before. And then Bernie Sanders is probably the one who got the most press coverage for his issue, saying that the big problem is overpopulation. And so the United States government needs to step up both legislation and funding to increase the abortion rate around the world,
mm-hmm.
and reduce pollution basically by killing people off. He even mentioned the Mexico City Agreement. That's another agreement that President Trump took America away from. The Paris Climate Change Agreement was giving money to Marxist dictatorships around the world to fight climate change. The Mexico City Agreement was giving money to third world countries to make abortions more affordable. Donald Trump took us out of that. Bernie Sanders wants to put us back into that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, like I said, you're getting all the things, like just numerous proposals, from amending the Constitution to banning plastic straws to banning hamburgers to killing your babies. And it would take a lot of time to debunk all of them. I'm hoping that most of our audience know. Well, those who followed this program for a while have known that we've I've covered before about the hamburger thing, that actually most areas of the world that are drying out, like sub-Saharan Africa, are drying out because they killed all the native wildlife. We killed 60 million buffalo. You killed all these zebra and elephants and wildebeest. And so you're having environmental degradation because there's no grazing animals. And so, like, the solution to some of these major environmental problems is that people need to eat more hamburgers, at least more grass-fed hamburgers. But
so it does seem like there's something rather hilarious about the fact that that CNN is trying so hard to address these issues, and they're putting these Democratic candidates in this forum where you have people who are asking extreme questions, and these Democratic candidates are looking for applause lines in front of an audience of quite radical people, significantly more to the left than the average American who might be watching this or might be hearing sound clips from it. There was one headline that said, Stephen Fleury referred to it this morning, that CNN's 7-hour climate change town hall was a man-made disaster for Democrat presidential candidates. Which it does seem like it's hard not to see this as something that is exposing the Democrats in a way that will really cause problems in the next presidential election. But what's interesting is Andrew Yang saying that we just need more power at the federal level in order to be able to enact these things. It shows you the direction that all of this is going in terms of just trying to have more authoritarian measures to make it possible to curb some of these activities.
Right. And that does get kind of moving towards the heart of this, is like something like banning plastic straws. I mean, maybe it'll help the ocean pollution a little bit, but it's not going to change the world's climate. Actually, banning hamburgers is probably going to hurt the environment. So a lot of these proposals are either going to do nothing or hurt the United States. The only reason someone would support them is they're, one, legitimately deceived, or two, like Andrew Yang, they want an amendment or some other legal recourse that empowers the federal government. It's more about government and control than about climate change. And we actually have an article we can put in the show notes by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, titled What the Paris Climate Change Agreement Was Really About. That's something he wrote after President Trump took us out of that agreement. And he makes that point really powerfully, where he says that climate change has become something like a religion for the radical left. They believe it as an article of faith, regardless of the evidence. It's a tool they are using to increase their control. And then a little later in the article, he goes into many people become very emotional about climate change, and in some cases completely lose their tempers when they go on TV. Satan thrives by using such attitudes and emotions. If you're guided by your feelings, the devil can use that. The weaker America is, the more vulnerable it is to being controlled. So now you're getting down at the very base level. I mean, Mr. Fleury calls the Satan, the devil, out specifically as wanting to weaken and destroy America. A lot of these things, I mean, banning hamburgers and suing oil companies, are going to hurt America's economy, going to hurt private industry at the expense of increasing the federal government's control. So you're attempting to weaken the nation, increase federal power, and enact a bunch of programs that really aren't going to address the environmental issues the Earth is really facing. I think the only decent suggestion I heard was the, from an environmental standpoint, was the use less plastic straws. And even that has nothing to do with climate. It would just be nice if the world had a little less plastic. Mm-hmm. But
The point too that Gerald Fleury makes is the fact that the more people are distracted by this, the less they recognize God's hand in the weather, and the fact that he does use it as a corrective measure against a sinful mankind. And if people are considering the sins that are causing these problems, things like the use of gasoline or hamburgers, they're being distracted away from addressing real, actual man-made sins that are bringing these kinds of disasters on us increasingly. So we'll definitely put a link to that article from Gerald Fleury in the show notes, what the Paris Climate Change Agreement was really about. And we appreciate that. Andrew, you're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we'll look at Iran's inroads into Yemen, elections in Germany, China stealing American military secrets, and a troubling trend among American farmers. We'll be right back.
Is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
We spoke in the first half about Iran working to consolidate its presence in Syria. Well, it's undertaking similar efforts in Yemen. For this story, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
I spoke about this a little bit in last week's Week of Review, but there was just a great article that came out by Jonathan Speier today that highlighted the fact that the Houthi movement in Yemen, which is the Iranian Alliance movement, Shiites there in northwestern Yemen. And he shows that they are really going to be there to stay. There's a lot of ways that they're moving to consolidate their power. And what looks like we are going towards a fractured Yemen, that there is going to be potentially two states. The U.S. said yesterday that they are officially in talks with the Houthis about some type of peace arrangement that can stop the fighting there. And the Houthis have just really come a long way in the past 4 years. They took over the capital back in 2015. And at the time, they were Iranian aligned for sure. And they were getting weapons from Iran. We spoke about how Iran wanted to use them as a tool for their greater ambition at controlling the Red Sea passageway and all maritime trade through there, and showed how that's what Bible prophecy says. But it was a question about just how powerful they're going to be. Are they going to be able to have a state, their own state? So in the past 4 years, we've seen them develop their own technology with the help of the Iranians, missiles just that can fly 800, 900 kilometers into Saudi Arabia, drones that can fly 1,000 kilometers and hit, you know, Emirati oil fields. This is what they're doing on a weekly basis. And then what we've had over the past, let's say, 3 weeks is an official state starting to emerge. They've appointed their first ambassador of the Republic of Yemen, is what they're calling this Houthi state. This ambassador, of course, you guessed it, where's it ambassador to? It's ambassador to Iran. And he's already visited Iran. He's met with the Ayatollah. He's met with military leaders. And gone are the days when we spent the first 5 minutes talking about Yemen, proving that there is a connection between the Houthis and Iran, and everyone was like, no there's not.
Right.
It's out there now, and they're okay with everyone knowing that this is an Iranian ally, with, or even closer than that, it's a I wouldn't want to call them just a straight out proxy, but they are aligned with Iran's will. And this is really creating a dangerous situation for Saudi Arabia. there. It's also creating a dangerous situation for Israel, considering the amount of trade that Israel receives through the Red Sea as well. And of course, it's creating a very dangerous situation for all maritime trade through this passageway. But how do you get rid of this native population that lives in Yemen, that wants their independence, and that has all the military hardware it needs to fight for it? Do you continue a war that's leading to civilian deaths? The Americans don't want that. The United States Senate and Congress have voted to stop American support in this war because of the civilian casualties. And so do you just let it go and allow Iran to have a beachhead on the Red Sea? It looks like that's what we're moving towards.
That's the sense that you're getting that you're getting from this, that basically we're seeing the development of a new status quo here.
Yeah, a status quo that puts Iran expanding Iran's power across the Middle East. We talked about how they want to get to the Mediterranean right before through Syria and Lebanon. And here we have one of the other important waterways in the Red Sea here with an Iranian asset right there on the shores of that. And this is very dangerous, as even Jonathan Speier brings out in his piece. He writes this towards the end. He says, rather, the Houthi-controlled part of Yemen appears set to emerge as an additional platform for the projection of Iranian power. Mm-hmm. Go back and read Mr. Joe Flory's article. It's called Iran Gets a Stranglehold in the Middle East. And that's what we said was going to happen, that they are going to be able to control Yemen to the point that they can choke the trade through this very critical artery leading to the Mediterranean from the Indian Ocean. That's what Mr. Gerald Flory wrote. And they are going to use it to project their power. What do the Iranians really care about some desolate wilderness on the southern tip of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula? They don't really care for the Houthi movement to receive their freedom. They care about what they can get in terms of power. And they become the gatekeeper of the Red Sea with such an ally there. And this falls in line with biblical prophecy. If you read that article by Mr. Gerald Flory, you'll see how the scriptures at the end of the book of Daniel in Daniel chapter 11 talk about this king of the south, which is Iran and radical Islam, controlling the Red Sea passageway, controlling this waterway based on the nations there that are aligned with it. It doesn't mention Yemen, but it mentions Egypt. It mentions Ethiopia. And so from that, we can see the strategy. And so Yemen's action falls in line with that completely as well. Here is the first step for Iranian control of the Red Sea. It's almost a done deal. But this is just the first place to go. We've got to watch also for Ethiopia and Egypt to eventually make their switch as well.
Thank you very much for that fascinating information there. And we'll definitely link to Gerald Flory's article, Iran Gets a Stranglehold on the Middle East, in the show notes for the program today. Thanks, Brent. Regional elections in Germany on Sunday brought results that are sure to trouble anyone hoping for greater political stability in that country. For this story, we'll go back to Daniel DeSanto.
All right, well, AfD scored some major victories this past weekend. They grew in Brandenburg all the way up to 23.5%. So the Brandenburg increase was 11.3%. That's over 2014. In Saxony, the party grew by 18%, and they went up to 27.8% total. Yeah. They are now the second largest party in both Brandenburg and Saxony. And they've also toppled the current coalition that was there before, now that majority is gone. So those mainstream parties will have to find a new coalition. Of course, they don't want to work with the AfD, but we're definitely seeing more AfD in the parliament, and we could even see a coalition of necessity at some point.
And tell us a little bit about the AfD. What is the alternative for Deutschland Party?
Well, this is Germany's far-right party, as it's always called. Really, it's a party that wants to make Germany strong on a world scene. It's a party that says that Germany's past shame and guilt is not really necessary anymore, that it's time for Germany to move on and redefine itself. So this is a very popular party in the East, primarily, not so much in the West, although they still have their supporters there, primarily because the East has suffered a lot more, and they've seen some of the results of Angela Merkel's poor policies. They're still poorer, they're still lagging behind in development in many ways. So reality is a bit harsher on that side of the country, and as a result, they have a lot of support in that in those states.
So how are people responding to this? This is obviously a trend that we've been watching for quite some time, the rise in the right in Germany, and more Germans who are finding the views of the AfD to be aligning with their own views. But this is obviously something that's quite at odds both with mainstream politics and with probably the more leftist press within the country. What's the response to the election result?
Right. Well, the main response has been it could be worse. Most headlines are saying, oh, well, we expected AfD to do even better and they didn't win. They're not the biggest party, so everything's all right. So we can just ignore it. The primary response is, well, we're glad that they're not winning more. And really, it's just a way of avoiding, in effect, the reality that they are now the second largest party.
And what might this mean going forward?
Well, it means for Germany that they're facing a new reality and they can't really ignore it, although some of them want to. Merkel's successor, who we call her AKK for short, as always, she was saying, no, we can't work with these people. We're never going to work with them in parliament. But going forward, this is going to become a necessity, especially if we see more AfD victories in upcoming elections. So we'll definitely be watching for that to see just if all of East Germany eventually has AfD as the second largest party or if they even win in some provinces.
And where would you send people if they want more information about why this is significant prophetically?
Well, we can. There's an article on one of AfD's policies, actually, that's very prophetic as well. The Heart of Germany's Military is Being Revived by Josue Michels. That's on this specific one because the AfD is proposing to revive Germany's military in some incredible ways.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Daniel. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. How deep and how damaging has China's theft of American military secrets been? A new book gives some startling insights. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this is a really powerful new book by Bill Gertz. He's one of the foremost experts on Chinese security affairs. And the basic premise of it is, as you said, just how systematic China's theft of U.S. military technology in recent years has been. So the book focuses mainly on China's theft of technology from U.S. defense contractors. And it shows that every year, China uses its vast and just incredibly well-organized network of hackers to steal somewhere in the neighborhood of $600 billion worth of U.S. intellectual property. And this tactic, it lets China pilfer very inexpensively these technologies that the U.S. invested untold billions, in many cases, into developing. So, you know, developing a new weapon or some other new technology is wildly inefficient. It's exorbitantly expensive because for every project that ends up paying dividends and becoming viable, there may have been 10 or 12 projects that were scrapped along the way that nothing came of. So being the innovator of new technologies is staggeringly expensive. And for China to wait until the U.S. has spent all of that money and then see what works and to quietly steal it, reverse engineer it, slap a Made in China sticker on it, and then mass produce it, it's, you know, it's just nauseating to see how much this is costing the U.S., but it's a very effective strategy for helping China to work toward achieving its goal of dominance.
It's interesting to look at, say, numbers of the amount that that the United States spends on its military, and you look at just how much more it spends than all the other nations. I think it's something like the next six or seven nations combined, and people look at that and say, well, this definitely shows that America's military power is unquestioned and it's unquestionable. And yet this is one of those of many factors that show that just raw dollar amount doesn't necessarily tell the full picture in terms of how much power a nation has. And China is definitely doing a whole lot more with the money it has by using these kinds of underhanded techniques.
Yes, that's a great point. For in terms of bang for the buck, or yep, bang for the yuan, maybe you could say, a Chinese defense dollar is buying far more firepower for their military than a U.S. dollar is, because they're typically stealing and copying what works, whereas we're squandering lots and lots of wealth to try to be on the cutting edge.
What are your thoughts on just how the U.S. can defend itself from this, or what sort of policies have kind of opened the door for China to be able to take these measures?
Yeah, that's a great point. One of the points that Bill Gertz makes is that up until Donald Trump became president in 2016, the U.S. leadership intentionally kept all details of China's theft as tightly held secrets. So starting back in the 1990s, America actually covered up this theft that it is the victim of in order to appease China. The hope was that ignoring this evil would eventually lead China away from authoritarianism toward democracy and free markets. But Bill Gertz writes, quote, "Instead, a hated Communist Party regime was not only perpetuated, but strengthened at the expense of America's most precious intellectual resources." So, you know, it wasn't until spring of last year that President Trump really opened up the books on this and showed just how systematic the theft is. And I think that is how to end it. First of all, by shining the spotlight on it, ending the shameful policy of this defeatist idea of covering it up.
Yeah, that's incredibly naive, isn't it?
It is.
To think that would somehow neutralize the Chinese threat.
Right. Well, that was the China fantasy that sustained the world for, you know, throughout the 80s and 90s, that we're opening up to China and they're going to liberalize, they will reform, they'll become a democracy soon enough. And in recent years, we've seen just how naive and foolish that fantasy was.
Well, we will put a link to an article that we have on the website, China Steals U.S. Trade Secrets and Fulfills Bible Prophecy, in the show notes. And you can look for that at the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. We'll end with a mystery. Among American farmers, there's been a notable increase in suicides. For some answers as to why, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, suicide is a major problem in the United States, especially amongst farmers. Data from the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention shows that Americans who work in farming, fishing, and forestry have some of the highest suicide rates in the nation. Those suicide rates, they've actually increased 34%, at least 34% since the year 2000. Jumping from 2.9 suicides per 100,000 farm workers in the year 2000, all the way up to 17.3 suicides per 100,000 farmers in 2016. That's the latest year for which data is available, and there's anecdotal evidence that it may be even higher than that now. To put that in perspective, farmers are 1.5 times as likely to commit suicide as the nation at large.
So why?
It's a good question. The American Farm Bureau Federation's done polling that 91% of farmers think that financial issues are negatively impacting farmers' mental health. Over the past few years, low crop prices and natural disasters like droughts in California or the flooding they've had in the Midwest have really hurt farmers. The trade war with China is making things even worse. China recently announced that it's not buying American agricultural products, most American agricultural products, which has already set America's farming sector back $1.3 billion this year. So bankruptcies are increasing. There's been a 530-something Chapter 12 farm bankruptcies this year, or the year that ended in June. And so that's an increase in every part of the economy except the Southwest. And so that is a big reason that a lot of people are putting forward as the reason for this. They had one of the vice president of the National Farmers Union was on Fox News saying that we have a lot of farmers, a lot more bankruptcies, a lot more suicides. These things are being highlighted in many of our news stories. And then another soybean farmer who actually went on CNN saying that farmers are not getting their credit lines renewed, banks are coming in and foreclosing on their farms, taking their family living away, and it's just too much for some of them. We've seen a definite increase in the suicide rate and depression in the U.S., especially in the upper Midwest.
Why is this significant prophetically?
Well, we have an article on the website now. Might not be in the top spot, but it's titled, Why Are U.S. Farmers Killing Themselves? And it highlights a prophecy in the book of Joel, an end time prophecy for the United States, specifically about crop failures. In Joel 1 and verse 10, it says, the field is wasted, the land mourns, the corn is wasted, the new wine is dried up, the oil languishes. Be ashamed, O you husbandmen, howl, O you wine dressers, for the wheat and the barley, for the harvest of the field is perished. And so this particular prophecy is talking about like mourning and depression amongst America's husbandmen and wine dressers and farmers due to crop failures. And then there's other prophecies that put the trade war factoring into that as well. That just show that this collapse of American agriculture is going to cause mourning and depression as these economic curses ramp up on America. And that is what you're starting to see with this suicide rate going up, where people are mourning and depressed over their languished fields to the point where they take their own life.
Very tragic and very alarming. We do appreciate you bringing that to us, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com. You find links to the articles and literature we discussed on today's program. You can email us your thoughts to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Daniel DeSanto, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Winston Churchill, I should have made nothing if I had not made mistakes. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.